Welcome back to the Lars Resort. Back in action after a bad week at the resort. The resort that's been in quarantine. It's been quarantined off. The health inspector has had to arrive. We had an outbreak of some kind of disease at the resort. Not good. Everything had to be closed off. No people in or out. Disinfect all the surfaces. Burn all the sheets. How did this happen? I hear you say. Nobody said that. But you know, back when we were doing the OG Norwegian pod, we used to have like a weirdly, I used to have like a weirdly intimate relationship with the listeners when it came to like health things, because obviously I broke my leg rather spectacularly, and we had almost weekly updates, like to what extent, like how many bits of metal are in my foot now? Is my tibia attached again? Stuff like this. With the foot news was a cherished part of the OG Norwegian pod. I don't know how much detail I should go into here. I expect no detail is the amount of detail that you want. I'll just say as a background, I went to Manchester. I went to Old Trafford to watch United Fulham. And I guess there is an obvious joke there about going to Old Trafford and catching the plague. But I gotta say, I was feeling a bit funky even before the game, as I'm not entirely inclined to blame the catering situation at Old Trafford for this. More the entire city of Manchester I'm blaming. But yeah, got real ill afterwards. It didn't stop. It went on and on. As it became like that thing from Succession when Cousin Greg is this business with when he brings doggy bags into work to try to nab some food, and he says, I think the quote is, I don't want to be melodramatic, but my body is growing weak from lack of sustenance. That was me last week. I lost almost 4 kilos in a week, which in and of itself is not a bad thing. I am on a diet, as you may know, but I don't, like, 4 kilos in a week is something's gone badly wrong. But I am yet again absorbing nutrients. So, you know, good times. I feel better. Yeah, podcast. The football, huh? Football. Good, isn't it? So being at Man United Fulham and seeing that up close was actually pretty good preparation for the Manchester Derby, in the sense that I was completely convinced that this would be close to a non-contest. You know, I had City with a -1 handicap on the weekly booster treble with Betson, which landed this weekend. That and two other things. There's two weekends in a row now, which means we're on a hat trick for the coming weekend. Exciting. But yeah, I had really no faith in United whatsoever. And it was a funny game in that if you didn't watch it and you just saw the result, the 3-1, you're just, yeah, okay. And you just saw the stats and you're saying, yeah, that looks about right. You would think this was exactly the game you were expecting it to be. Man City just kind of wiping the floor with United. But of course, because United got an early goal, a brilliant and an improbable strike in so many ways. I believe the XG was actually just the middle finger emoji on that one. And because City kind of weren't at their fluid best, and because Erling Haaland missed a chance, missed a very big chance, the biggest of chances, you sort of got the sort of creeping feeling going into halftime that, huh, maybe this could be one of those days. But City, you know, it was just over half an hour left, and City were still 1-0 down, so in that sense. But also, in those first, I think it was 56 minutes before the equaliser, thereabouts, and I looked it up. I mean, City had 21 shots, and United had 2, which seems bad. So maybe City were not at their most sort of fluid, totally swashbuckling, exciting best, but they were just, like, fully dominant. And there is a conventional wisdom that you have to sit back against Man City, but I don't know if I really buy that. I think you look to Jurgen Klopp, for instance, one of the few managers who have a pretty good record against Guardiola. He was asked about, you know, how you approach this, and I bring this quote up a lot because I just thought it was kind of well articulated. He says, you have no alternatives to beat City than going on the front foot. You know, he was asked about, you have no alternatives to beat Man City. Yes, you can win the lottery and they tackle each other. Then you can stand deep in your own box, and in the end you hope nothing happens. But it's not really likely. And this is the thing. You with sitting back and allowing a city to move the ball around, you know, they more often than not, they will find that opening. You're definitely not going to go out and have 60% possession. That's very unlikely. But I do think you have to try to disrupt their passing a little bit and not let them find some kind of rhythm. And just completely sitting back. Like, they will find the opening sooner or later. And they did in this game as it went on through Phil Foden. And what United did do well, I guess, we should flag up, being completely fair, aside from his horrible miss, of course, I did think they did a reasonable job defending against Haaland. There were quite a few times in the game, I was watching him very closely, as I do, where he wanted to make the kind of run that he wants to make or move into the box in the way he, you know, only to just kind of find that someone was in the way there. I mean, they did a pretty decent job tracking him and occupying the spaces that he wanted to move into. I know we're not giving United a lot of credit for this performance overall, but I thought in terms of like protecting yourself against the baby boy, that wasn't a bad effort. But overall, I really felt for Erik ten Hag when he was asked if there's a gulf in class between the two teams, because obviously there is, right? But he can't really say that. He's been in charge for 100 games. The club has spent a lot of money. He's had power of veto over incoming transfers. And if you look at the transfers, so many of them are like Dutch or Eredivisie guys or guys from his own agency. Or like they're clearly his guys that have been brought in. You have a new minority owner who's come in, who's going to be running the club, apparently. He just did a press briefing where he talked about wanting to knock City off their perch in a sort of very obvious reference to Sir Alex and Liverpool back in the day. It's just not a great look then for the current head coach that you get played off the park by City and afterwards go, well, yeah, of course, you know, they're miles ahead of us, duh. Like, it's not a great look for him. And but speaking of great looks, I didn't think whinging about the ref was a very great look for him either, because this is a game in which the opponent had 27 shots and United had three shots in 90 minutes. Eric, mate, like, this was not about the ref. The ref did not lose you that game. So actually banging on about the referee, I thought, was kind of poor. But then again, what are you supposed to say? Like, it's tough for the Man United manager to come out and say, yeah, the City are miles better than us. I've been here for a while now, but the gap is not closed at all. What can I tell you? That's not an amazing thing for him to have to admit in public, but that is the truth. They're just miles off. When comparing to sort of the best teams around, United are just not in that conversation, and they're not much closer than they were 100 games ago. That is the reality of the Erik ten Hag era. I don't know how fair it is to compare with Man City. I mean, even this current Man City team, who are a little way off their best form, are still one of the better teams we've seen in the league. But instead, compare to when City play Liverpool or when City play Arsenal. Compare that to when they play United. At least those games are competitive. The United games, they look more like when City are playing Palace or any other sort of mid-table rando team. Over the two Manchester derbies this season, Manchester United have had 10 shots and City have had 48. Like, seems bad, you guys. Like, this is not what you want. And like, United had injuries, sure. How many of them are actual starters? Martinez and Højlund would start. Luke Shaw starts. So I guess three starters out. Maguire maybe. But then if Martinez is fit, then him and Varane is probably your best defensive partnership. So I'd say three starters absent. And those absences hurt. But I still think the bottom line here is that under 100 games with Ten Hag, they're no closer to catching up with City. Like, the distance is as big as it was. And I feel like it's almost more damning for United what I just mentioned, that Arsenal, what Arsenal have done in that time, kind of feels like it makes United look bad. Because the season before Ten Hag took over at United, Arsenal finished 5th, United finished 6th, Arsenal had finished 8th 2 seasons in a row before that. Now, United did manage to qualify for the Champions League last season, that is true. But in terms of actually developing a team that works, they're miles off. And in the meantime, Arsenal have shown that it is actually possible for other teams to close the gap on City and Liverpool, I guess. So you can't really say, oh, City are so good, it's impossible to compete with them. It's clearly not true. It is possible. Arsenal have been able to do it. Liverpool have been able to do it for years. It's just that United are just too busy treading water to kind of develop anything. And, I mean, their recent record, actually not that terrible. 2 defeats, 1 draw, and 7 wins. That looks pretty good in the last 10. But we've had this conversation with Peter, who's a big Man United fan, who watches these games very closely. are anyone convinced that United have actually been playing much better? Or has it just been a case of, like, Osmond Hoyland hitting form and then his goals meaning that some of these kind of chaotic games have been tilted in United's favour? Like, I know which one of those two I'm leaning towards. So, poor, poor day at the office for Erik ten Hag and Man United. The other weird thing in this sort of week, 10 days, where I've been kind of out of commission with a sort of gastrointestinal disaster, is that the Marcus Rashford discourse that I've caught bits and pieces of, and I'm just kind of catching up on now, very weird, I think. So before the Fulham game, I was doing my sort of regular weekend morning bit on TalkSport on Saturday morning. I do just a 15-minute type of thing with Max Rushton and the guys. And they would do like a sponsored segment of who has the biggest mission that weekend. And usually you just kind of say whoever's playing Man City, right? That is usually the biggest mission of the weekend, like whoever's playing Man City. But I wanted to be a bit more creative, and I thought about it. And I thought, you know what? Marcus Rashford for me. Because United's recent run of improved form was just massively fueled by Rasmus Hojlund's goals, right? But now that Hojlund's injured and Rashford's had a flat season, you know, he's 26 now. He signed a huge new contract after prolonged negotiations last summer. He's now one of the best paid players at United, one of the best paid in the league. And at his age, with that status, I think with that comes an expectation that he should be one of the people really doing the heavy lifting for United. He's not a kid anymore. Like, he's an elite footballer. He's been acknowledged and is paid accordingly. At 26, he should be in his prime physically. Now that Hojlund's injured, they really need him to step up and play to the level that we know he's capable of. And we know because we've seen it, right? That's why they're paying him so much. Now, when I was at the Fulham game, I kept a pretty close eye on him. And wow, he was terrible. Like, it's really bad. And one thing is that, okay, he doesn't like playing as a striker. Fine. But again, you're 26. You're not a kid. He's 26. He's played almost 150 games as a striker in his career. I don't think you can excuse putting in just a total non-performance at home against Fulham because you'd rather be on the wing. Like, that's not good enough. I'm sorry. But more to the point, I was watching him, and there was just a number of times where he clearly just decided not to run, whether it was a turnover where he should have tracked back, or whether he was in a position to press someone, or he just didn't want to move. And it reminded me of watching a player who was 36, not 26, someone who's 36 and knows he has to conserve his energy. It actually, like, this is an absurd comparison maybe, but like years and years ago, I was in the US and I watched the Portland Timbers versus the Seattle Sounders. And the Sounders had a pretty old Obafemi Martins up front. And then Martins was still pretty quick. But you could tell every time the ball was played in his general direction, it was like he did a double take. Like, he hesitated and thought, is this worth burning off some of my very limited stamina? Like, he only had a small number of sprints in him per game. And he had to really think long and hard before he burned off some of that fuel. Now, I actually thought Rashford was playing like this. And he's 26. He should be at his peak physically. He just seems to have made the decision not to run a lot. Now, I get why this leads some fans and some of the media to call him lazy and accuse him of not caring and all that. But I think that's one of the things that fans, and again, not just fans, us in the media, that we get wrong the most often. Like, from speaking to players over the years and getting to know a few of them, one of the things that we get wrong the most is the idea that players go on the pitch and think, nah, can't really be bothered today. Like, that just doesn't happen very often. Extremely rarely at this level. To even get to the point where when you're on a pitch in a game like this, you have to be such a driven individual that you're just not the type of person who's just going to go on a football pitch and just, yeah, I can't be arsed to run today. That doesn't happen. 30, 40 years ago, maybe it was still possible to kind of float to the top on pure talent. But now the physical demands are so high that those sort of players with a more casual attitude, you don't really see them anymore. You have to put in so much work. You have to be so driven to get there. I kind of miss those players, to be honest, but you don't really see them. So this sort of not caring and not being arsed, it isn't really a thing, or at least it's an exceedingly rare thing. Now, what does happen, and what does happen more often than we think, is that players are carrying injuries, that they're not 100% physically fit for some reason. The club doesn't really want to be public about it. That happens more than we're aware of. And what also happens more than we're aware of is that players have got stuff going on in their personal lives that affect them, that can affect their confidence, their focus, that can make it hard to really just perform to the peak of your abilities. Not that you're sort of, again, not that you don't want to run, but you can lack the Norwegian word overskudd. I don't know what the English equivalent of that. Just having surplus energy that you have when things are going well. You can just kind of be zapped of that, and that can really take stuff out of you. And because of personal things that you can't talk about in public, that stuff happens. Now, watching Rashford against Fulham, my first thought was that he must be carrying an injury. Like, this guy must be hurt or something. And I started kind of asking around, and no one could really confirm anything. But after the Manchester derby, Ten Hag did say, I got the quote here, he said, he had his problems with an injury, so he fought for 70 minutes, but then I had to take him off. The wording of that kind of makes it sound to me like this is an ongoing thing, which would explain some of it, to be honest, that he's not 100% right physically and he has to really conserve himself and protect himself. That would make sense, because I was kind of taken aback by how poor he was, yeah, but also how like reluctant he was to move, basically. So a few days later, when I was having a terrible time with my body, I did notice that he was doing, he had done a big Players Tribune piece, and I thought, yes, great, maybe we'll learn what is going on with Marcus Rashford, like, why are you like this? But it was actually just this really big thing about how much he likes Man United, which honestly, I was like, what? Did anyone doubt that? Maybe if you go on the internet, like the most rabid fan corners of the internet, you just go, like, you don't care, bruv. He's overpaid. And he's like, you get some of those guys on the internet, I guess. But like, we know that he's a Man United kid and all this sort of stuff. I'm just more interested in why he's not moving. And like, are you injured? Are you unwell? Like, what's happening? It was just a weirdly defensive piece, I thought, about why people are always on his back. And, you know, he says he's just a 26-year-old lad and all of that. And I don't know, you guys. You know, for me, he's not a lad anymore. That is not a category Marcus Rashford fits in. He's one of the senior pros at Manchester United and one of the best paid players in the league. Like, Kobbie Mainoo is a lad. Garnacho is a lad. Marcus Rashford has played almost 400 games for Man United. In footballing terms, he is a grown-up, not a lad. And it is not unreasonable to expect him to act accordingly, I really don't think. And it's not unreasonable that he's being criticised. He's scored 6 goals this season. That's the same number as Neil Maupay and Juan Vissa and Rodri. Like, not good for a forward for Man United. And he's averaging 0.28 goals per 90. That's roughly the same as Alex Iwobi and Beto. Like, not good, Marcus. So if you're going to do, like, your Players Tribune piece, the floor is yours. You can say literally anything. If you're carrying an injury, tell us. There's no reason not to. If something's bothering you so you're not moving properly, just tell us. If something's going on in your life, maybe hint towards that, or maybe there's stuff you can't talk about, I don't know. But, like, people are being mean, and I really like Man United. Like, we knew that. That doesn't add anything to the conversation. So, very confusing all around, I thought. And then the City game was kind of infuriating because he scores a great, great goal. Just a magnificent hit. And then he was largely terrible for the rest of it. So he kind of both, he scored a wonder goal to hit back at the critics and the haters and the losers. And then he did exactly the same stuff that he's being criticized for mostly in the game. So I just thought, let's just take a step back and just look at cold, hard numbers. What does his numbers say for the season? You know, like I said, his goals per 90 is 0.28. That is the lowest it has been in any season since he was 18. His assists per 90 is 0.09, which is also the lowest since he was 18. His non-penalty XG plus expected assists per 90, so like a general sort of productivity metric, is 0.36, which is the lowest in any of the last 7 seasons. You know, the seasons FBref have had XG data for. Tackles won per 90 and blocks per 90, also the lowest in the last 7 seasons. He's averaging fewer touches per game than in any of the last 7 seasons. His number of carries and total carrying distance, both the lowest they've been in the last 7 seasons. He's having the worst season of his career, plain and simple. Now, I am sure there is a reason for that, and I'm sure the reason for that is not that he doesn't want to be better. I don't buy that. I don't think that's the case. And I wish he would tell us, or at least say something about it. And doing a Players Tribune piece about how much he likes Man United, that's not it. That's not what the situation needed, I don't think. But he did score a great goal, to be fair to him. Hopefully this is just a physical thing. Maybe some time off in the international break will help him. Maybe it's something the club can figure out, and that we'll see a better version of him towards the end of the season. Because United are not totally out of this Champions League spot race. This might sound silly, but If we're assuming it's going to be five, I still think it'll be five. And I don't trust Spurs or Villa to not have a slump at some point between now and the end of the season. So United, I think they've got every chance of making up some of that ground, even if they're not very good. So good Marcus Rashford could really get them there. Anyway, a lot about United, a lot about Rashford. What else happened this weekend? Well, the Moisening is on pause. Looks like it's not happening anyway. They've won two games. They're up to seventh. It's all coming up Moisey. Not talking about Moyes more on this podcast, but this weekend it was very typical for the way the season has gone. West Ham were outshot by a lot. They were out XG'd by a lot. And then they won the game 3-1. Because of course they did. And because they were playing Everton. And Everton, yet again, putting up good XG numbers and failing to win a football match. This is deja vu all over again with Everton. And it made me think of just what a weird journey Sean Dyche has been on with this stats stuff. And I'm going to get into the weeds a little bit, but I want to take a moment to talk about this because I remember, and many of you will remember, back in the autumn of 2017, Sean Dyche was in charge of Burnley. Burnley were doing unexpectedly well in the league. And we had this really weird situation of Burnley being in the top half of the table, even though they conceded more shots than almost anyone else in the league. It was just really weird. They ended up finishing seventh that season, and only Stoke City, who were relegated, conceded more shots per game than Burnley. It was peak Burnley, peak Dyche ball. They blocked the most shots in the league. They had the second highest number of clearances, won the second highest number of headers, and had the fourth lowest possession. It was just total Dyche. Dyche ball all around. Now, how did they do this? Well, Rory Smith did a very excellent piece for the New York Times about how Burnley were such a weird statistical oddity because you shouldn't be able to concede this many shots and without, you know, dying. And there were some interesting details there, like how Dyche had shown the Burnley players some DVDs, and one of the things they looked at was actually Rafa Benitez's Valencia team from the early 2000s, which totally scans because that was a very compact and aggressive team. But I particularly like this. Dyche talked about how they were standing off with a purpose. And the quote here is that the way it is designed is to put a player in a position that is statistically, visually, and from experience harder to score from, he said, or to allow the team to defend more bravely, to step out of their positions to move towards the ball because they know they have cover. It is to make a chance less of a chance. So they concede a ton of shots, but they like kind of funnel opposing players into areas where they're like, yeah, you can shoot from there. It's fine. You're not going to score from there. So a lot of those shots were from like ineffective areas. They were kind of sitting back and then giving people space to shoot from bad locations. And Dyche kind of found a way then to defy the numbers. Now, there was some regression eventually, and the magic kind of stopped working for Burnley, and they eventually like went down later. But that season, while Dyche was doing the magic, it was good stuff. Now, if we fast forward to now, things are very much the opposite for poor old Everton. I know I've said this before, but it remains fully, fully absurd. Everton have, I think, the sixth best XG difference in the league. Only Arsenal, City and Liverpool have conceded a lower XG number than Everton. They got on XG, Everton have got the fourth best defence in the league. And they're 16th. Some of that is the points deduction, but they're also, you know, they'd be far down even without that. Now, the problem, of course, is in the other end of the pitch. Everton are doing a lot of things right. They are putting the second most crosses into the box in the league, Brentford putting in the most. And then when your strikers are Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Beto, with Doucouré playing as the kind of Miley and Ashley Barnes, putting in a lot of crosses makes sense. It's what you want to do. Now Dyche has evolved a little bit. Everton are not as much of a low block team as his Burnley team was, but they do have the second lowest possession number in the Premier League. And they win more headers per game than anyone else. Their blocking and clearance numbers are not as high as Burnley's were, but I just think that's because they're better at keeping the opponent away from the goal. They don't sit deep constantly. But they do share one stat in common with Dyche's sort of peak Burnley team from 2017-2018, which is that Everton have attempted a higher number of long passes in the league than anyone else. They like to get it launched. And well, I suppose that is, I say that, that's not necessarily true. A long pass can be a big diagonal out to a winger rather than, you know, launching it as traditionally like an aimless hoof towards someone up there. So I think these sort of long diagonals, they come out as long passes. Anyway, the lowest average possession, the highest number of long passes attempted, second highest number of crosses into the box. That's Everton's style of play right there in three numbers, right? Direct, get it wide, get it into the box. And it should work. The model is fine, except Dominic Calvert-Lewin is like, I'm not saying all of it's his fault, but if we look at, if you look at non-penalty goals minus non-penalty XG, yeah, so the differential, the difference between the goals you've scored and the XG you've generated, you know, it's a good way of measuring how efficient you are with your finishing. DCL is by some margin the most wasteful player in the Premier League this season, followed by Jackson, as you'd expect, followed by Erling Haaland, perhaps surprisingly. But that's if we look at totals. That's just all in all. But if we adjust for playing time, right? If we look at who has the worst difference here per 90, we initially get a lot of noise because that'll take in players who've just come on as a sub a couple of times and missed some chances. They will obviously turn up high in the stats. I mean, poor David Washington, the young Chelsea striker, he's played like 9 minutes and missed a chance. So if you average that over 90, he has a minus 5 XG per 90, which is completely absurd, of course, though it's kind of funny. Now, if we look at the difference between XG and actual G, take away penalties, set to 90 minutes, and let's say we just look at players who have played more than 5 times 90 minutes in total, right? More than 5 times 90 minutes. And Dominic Calvert-Lewin is still the most wasteful striker in the Premier League, followed by Beto. Oh no, Everton. Again, if you look at I think it's probably the best way of measuring finishing efficiency. Everton have the two most wasteful strikers in the league. This is all from the FBRF website, by the way. The two Everton strikers, the least efficient strikers in the league. Tremendous stuff. Now, conventional wisdom with this is that it should even itself out over time. Both DCL and Beto have underperformed their XG before in their careers, suggesting that they're not great finishers, but neither have done so by this much before. It is usually not this bad. So logically, this should even itself out, but then again, psychology is a thing. And you can lose confidence, and you can get into a funk and a spiral, and you know the whole Timo Werner thing that we saw when he came to Chelsea. And they are also kind of slowly starting to run out of games for this to even itself out. Like, it's not that much left of the season. Now, I think Everton will be saved by the fact that there are three worse teams here. Unless there's another points deduction, then God knows. But I think they'll be fine. But it's just interesting to me that Sean Dyche, the man who once defied the stats, you know, the stats suggested this team should not be winning, and it won. Now it is the opposite. The stats suggest that this team really should be winning, and they're not. So what is the moral of this story? I don't know. I mean, man kick ball into goal, good. Man, no kickball into goal, bad. I think that's where we're at with this sort of advanced analysis stuff. I'm looking at you, DCL, and Beto, even though he did get a goal in the end. I was kind of Googling Sean Dyche, as I do on a daily basis, of course, to see what he said about XG. And that was really funny, because up came two videos from Sean Dyche press conferences. This was like number one and number two on the hits here. The first one was from September, and the headline was, "The XG is right up there," says Dyche, which of course it was, and continued to be. The second video is from a press conference for 2 weeks ago, where the headline is, in capital letters, Dyche saying, "We can't keep going on about XG," which I guess is true, both in this life and this podcast. But it's been a journey for Dyche with all of this. It must be incredibly frustrating for someone who is, I mean, I think he's too much of a proper football man to really acknowledge XG fully as a thing. You know, he has to say something about how he's not really a fan of it. But by the way, my XG is great right now. Anyway, it's fascinating and excruciating, and I feel like we've kind of come full circle with Dyche here. I've only just started looking at the weekend for the betting column. The weekly boosted treble has landed 2 weekends in a row now. So I was able to knock out a betting blog last week, even though I felt real bad. And the treble landed, so that's nice. So we're on a hat trick. Haven't quite decided what the treble is this week yet, but United are playing Everton, which I guess is funny, given everything we've spoken about in this episode. Problem with Everton, from a betting point of view, is that logically, if they keep doing what they're doing, results will turn. And if you catch that before the sort of market adjusts, I mean, the market's already pricing in the fact that their XG is really good, but like, I think there could be some value on them if you start hitting Everton just as this sort of form turns. But of course, it might not turn. And you also don't know when it's going to happen. So this game is a great case in point. Their XG difference across the season is significantly better than Man United's. And having seen United against Fulham, I'm very tempted to pick up this at maybe like a double chance with Everton or draw. That's on at evens. So that's... But we can combine that with under 3.5. Like, I don't think we'll have a ton of goals. So Everton or draw plus under 3.5 puts us at 290, which I think is an interesting price. But the thing is, in the end, I kind of feel that statistically, that's, if you look at the numbers and everything going on, I think that's an interesting bet. But the problem is, I think we all know what's going to happen here is that Everton are going to play well. DCL and Beto are going to hit a bunch of air shots, and then United will win 1-0 after like a deflected Bruno Fernandes shot from 30 yards or some bullshit like that. Like, that's how this game is going to go, probably. So I'm just going to stay away from that. That's kind of a logic on the one hand, intuition on the other, and it, like the Large Hadron Collider, there's kind of meeting in the middle, and no conclusion for me. But instead, I want to look at West Ham. The David Moyes, the return. He's unstoppable now. They won twice in a row. They're playing Burnley at home, right? And Burnley just look lost. They're just not very good at anything, Burnley. I don't know what they are as a team. They can't keep clean sheets. They don't attack particularly well. They just, what are they good at? And they must know the end is coming, so morale must be taking a hit. Vincent Kompany just kind of looks sad all the time. So, listen, a straight home win for West Ham is at 165. That's not an exciting price, but I think that's kind of fine. I'm pretty confident that West Ham will get this done. But what you could also do to make the price more interesting here is we can slap on over 1.5 goals. So West Ham to win and any other score than 1-0, 93% of West Ham's games in the league have gone over 1.5, right? They don't usually, because they tend to concede some goals, and they've got quite a lot of attacking weaponry. So if you add over 1.5 to a West Ham win, you get a price of 197, and that I think is good. That's going on the blog this weekend for sure. Put it very simply, do we think there's more than a 50% chance of West Ham winning this and there being more than one goal in the game? Yes, I think so. Very much so. So that's going on the blog. And then we'll see. I mean, very exciting to try to get a hat-trick of boosted trebles this weekend. Have to figure out a good treble. Haven't quite done that yet. But that would be cool if we could do it. Great to be back. Great to have a situation where my innards are currently functioning as prescribed. That is good stuff, you guys. And if you missed the pod over the last sort of two-ish weeks, if you suffered in my absence, believe me, I was suffering quite a lot more. And that is the last time we'll ever mention it. Probably. Bye!